News.
Russian forces made fresh gains near the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk, one of Ukraine's last strongholds in the eastern Donbass region.
Here in Brussels, tens of thousands of people protest against the soaring cost of living as the fallout from Russia's war in Ukraine kicks in.
An alliance of left-wing French parties says it's planning to put forward a no-confidence vote against President Macron's government next month. This is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting this broadcast with Ukraine, where Russian military is pressing ahead with operations to take the eastern region of Donbass. In the latest development, Russia and its allies made advances in areas near the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk. Pro-Russia forces say they've gained control of the town of Tashkikva. Kiev has confirmed that. It's also acknowledged reports that Russian forces have captured the settlement of Metyokin on Severodonetsk's eastern outskirts. Kiev says that Russian forces have stepped up their shelling in Donetsk as well as Kharkiv in the northeast. President Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects Russia to intensify attacks as Ukraine awaits the European Union's decision on its candidacy bid. EU leaders will discuss Kiev's membership at their summit this week. The country applied to join the bloc just a few days after Russia launched its war on February 24th. Tens of thousands of people have filled the streets of the Belgian capital, Brussels, to protest the rising cost of living in their country. Prices have gone up in recent months, with the inflation rate hitting 9% in June. The cost of energy also spiked in the wake of Russia's war in Ukraine. Meantime, security staff at the Brussels airport have gone on a strike, forcing the cancellation of departing flights. More than 230 flights have been affected. This is part of a national industrial action to demand better pay. Rail and airline strikes are also planned in several more European countries, including Britain, in the coming days to protest the rising cost of living. Jerome Hughes in Brussels has some details about the protesters and how they have affected the city. He also tells us about the high inflation rate in that country.
Normally, the protest would end here at South Station, where I am now, and there would be big screens and speeches and so on. But actually, the police, they banned this because when we've seen this type of protest in the past, it turned violent with skirmishes and riots with police. So that has been banned. So the transport system is sort of on its knees today throughout Monday in Brussels and in Belgium. And as you mentioned, the airports, the main airports in Zaventem and also Charleroi, all the flights have been cancelled throughout Monday. So there's going to be a lot of disruption, an enormous number of people unable to travel, including would-be holidaymakers. So there'll be a huge backlog when flights start to resume tomorrow morning, Tuesday. But speaking to the protesters here, what they've been telling me is that this is all about the cost of living. Inflation has gone through the roof. Oil, gas, electricity, food, moving from A to B, even getting to work is very difficult for many people. And they've come to the end of their tether, so to speak, in terms of getting a lack of assistance from the Belgian government and also from sort of the EU authorities. So they feel that not enough is being done.
French President Emmanuel Macron's landed in hot water after his party and its allies lost a majority in Sunday's parliamentary elections. The new left-wing alliance has now become the main opposition force as planned to bring a motion of no confidence against the Macron government next month. Macron's centrist alliance won most parliamentary seats in the Sunday vote, but fell short of a straight majority. French media has called the results a slap in the face for Macron. Critics say that voters turned against the president for being out of touch and elitist, while his party's rivals focus on the cost of living crisis. And that's the main concern of the French people these days.
French President Emmanuel Macron's coalition has been reprimanded at the ballot box in the second round legislative vote, failing to secure an absolute majority. However, he and the longtime Conservative Party are expected to continue to unite on neoliberal policies, and combined, they will control over half of parliament, with initial projections giving them 53%.
This is a country which is difficult to govern, with a lot of different demands. I don't see there being a big change for the average person over the next 5 years, but I do foresee a lot of difficulties.
In his first term, Macron routinely forced policies through by executive decree, even though he had a comfortable absolute majority, causing many to see the legislative vote as an empty formality. Thus, turnout reached just 46%, making abstention the real Democratic majority winner.
Voter participation was far from excellent, unfortunately. Hopefully, it won't hurt the credibility of the government when it comes to implementing reform.
The biggest winner was the far-right National Front, who more than doubled most poll predictions with around 90 seats, making them the third largest power in parliament and tripling their best score ever. When the results were announced, their election headquarters immediately chanted, "Macron resign," and they will likely play an unpredictable role in mainstream politics. The left-wing NUPES, Popular Front Alliance, promised much and under-delivered. With only 25% of seats, they are the main opposition party, but are small enough to be easily brushed aside by the right wing. The new kingmakers are the mainstream conservative party, but Macron's record of legalizing Islamophobia, far-right economic policies, often passed via authoritarian decree, and his brutal repression of the Yellow Vests has caused many to say for years that Macron is actually a mainstream conservative, but with a new party logo. Despite a prolonged period of once-in-a-century social unrest, the French political landscape has barely been changed. If essentially the same people in power don't change how they govern, many say the next 5 years could be dangerously explosive. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson narrowly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. And yet, he's decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the COVID pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Lynton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some 2 decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. it didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
Well, in essence, the UK has thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on Rwanda Agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and receives asylum procedures. The controversial £120 million deal is coming under heavy criticism as regards its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to the to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
Iran blaming the U.S. for stalled talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The foreign ministry spokesman says that President Biden's administration is pursuing the failed policy of its predecessors.
On one hand, you hear statements by some U.S. officials that they want to compensate for the mistakes by the Trump administration and be a responsible actor in the international system and observe international law. But on the other hand, you see them defy law and keep the failed policies of the Trump administration. With every sanction the U.S. adds, it makes it more difficult for itself to prove to the world public opinion that it's not taking the path of Trump. What we see is that some elements inside the U.S. and its government are doing all they can to keep Trump's legacy. Certainly, they can't keep Trump's legacy and at the same time return to the JCPOA. It's impossible.
Said Khatibzadeh held the U.S. responsible for the current situation regarding the JCPOA. He said it was Washington that withdrew from the accord in 2018 and tried its best to destroy the pact. The spokesman added that Tehran recently came up with an initiative to help the talks move forward, but the U.S. decided to push for an anti-Iran resolution at the UN nuclear watchdog to give leverage in the negotiations. Still, the diplomat said that Tehran is prepared to finalize a deal if Washington stops keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign and removes all sanctions. President of the Republic of Kazakhstan, Qasem Jomart Tokayev, has paid a visit to Iran to cement ties with the Islamic Republic. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has a report.
A warm welcome for a new chapter in the Iran-Kazakhstan relations. On Sunday, Kazakh President Qasem Jomart Tokayev arrived in Tehran at the invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. After an hour-long meeting, the two sides oversaw the signing of several cooperation documents on transport, energy, and tourism, among other areas.
Despite the existing geopolitical situation and restrictions, Kazakhstan and Iran managed to increase their bilateral trade by 50% over the past 3 months. With today's MOUs, I'm certain that we will achieve a lot more in our interactions.
Iran was the first country that recognized Kazakhstan's independence following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. That was when Tehran and Nur Sultan began their diplomatic ties. President Raisi says the two nations have never been closer.
This visit by the honorable Kazakh president is undoubtedly a milestone in Iran-Kazakhstan relations. Over the past 30 years, we have maintained fraternal ties with our neighbor, Kazakhstan, but the level of our relations need to be enhanced.
Iran and Kazakhstan are both members of the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO. This provides a safe trading channel for the two countries, without worries over the impacts of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
We need to expand our cooperation through regional organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union.
Since he took office less than a year ago, President Raisi has been trying to establish closer neighborly ties, as he believes this would obviate the need for Iran to wait for the fate of the ailing 2015 deal with the world powers to improve its economy.
Before the coronavirus pandemic, Iran and Kazakhstan's annual trade exceeded $1 billion. But the pandemic pushed this figure down to around $200 million. Today, the two presidents vowed to push the envelope of their country's commercial interaction and set a $3 billion mark for their annual trade. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In Syria, a terrorist attack on a civilian transit bus has killed at least 13 people, injuring three others, most of them government troops. The defense ministry is saying that the attack happened in the Raqqa province on a road linking to the city of Raqqa to Homs. 11 troops and two civilians were killed in the attack. Another three soldiers were wounded. No claim of responsibility. The region was once controlled by Daesh terrorists. The group's sleeper cells have performed similar attacks over the past months, leaving dozens dead or wounded. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic Divide.
When it comes to the new world order, that obviously will include a new financial order. But for that to happen, it's a tall order. But it is in motion. Two countries that are leading the way in establishing the mechanics of this, they are Russia and Iran. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai, and this is Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the sanctioned ones. Iran and Russia are setting the new rules. They're doing that because they want to break the West's global financial grip. Will that happen, and how are they going about it? Also coming up in this program, we will take a look at the new settlement currency. It's pegged to the national currencies, and as a result, that will lead to the dollar collapse and undermine U.S. military and political power. Then we will take a look at the new, what's called RIC. That's right, RIC, to stand for Russia, Iran, and China. They're integrating their financial systems. And one of the things that's important is Iran, which is important to China in doing that.
The war in Ukraine and the ensuing crisis that emerged between Russia and the West has shifted the geopolitics and strategic alliances in Europe, West Asia, and Eurasia. Following the crisis, Russia was hit with a series of unprecedented sanctions that were aimed at making the country's economy collapse. But Russia appears to have survived the crisis. Moscow has now decided to shift its strategic partnership toward the East and to develop closer ties with countries like Iran and China. Iran has welcomed the move since it has been under Western unilateral sanctions for years. But over the years, Iran has managed to thwart Western economic pressures and revive its economy. The two countries, with China on their side, are now determined to further boost their ties in an effort to create a partnership that are immune to Western interference. Even before the war began in Ukraine, Iran and Russia were mulling to significantly boost their trade ties. When President Raisi visited Russia in January of this year, the two sides discussed a draft agreement on strategic cooperation for the next 20 years. Things now appear to fast-track between Russia and Iran, since both Moscow and Tehran are under Western sanctions. Barter arrangements are gaining ground. Tehran is offering spare parts and gas turbines to Moscow's power plants in exchange for much-needed zinc, aluminum, lead, and steel for its metal and mining industries. And more barter on a wide range of commodities is ahead, as discussed during a recent visit to Tehran by the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak.
Social media posts on this topic were varied, even though some out there are aware that there is a major transformation that's taking place, which will push the U.S. and Western countries down the global order a notch or two. The majority remain in the dark, which is why we are here. This is our first post. Russia now faces a greater number of U.S. sanctions than every other nation combined. The world's most sanctioned countries include two of India's neighbors, Myanmar and Iran. Now missing from the list are two other neighbors, each with a record of renegade actions, Pakistan and China. Next up, sanctions are a new form of warfare, causing the same amount of mass suffering and death. This is according to Abby Martin from the Empire Files. She says the goal is to decimate entire economies for refusing to bow down to the will of the empire. Next up, while the U.S. is busily impoverishing the EU and imposing sanctions that hurt their economy, Russia and China are opening the first automobile bridge across the Amur River between the two countries to start cargo traffic that will help boost trade turnover to $200 billion. Here's a viewer comment that says Janet Yellen is saying the restrictions on Russia are hurting U.S. homes, yet sanctions are effective. How can any sane individual support such nonsense? And our final post, soon President Xi will meet with Saudi Arabia King Salman. Could this be a new Quincy Pact? Drop the petrodollar and start working on a new financial system. Saudi Arabia has been supporting Russia on Ukraine and has very close ties with China. And it's not even taking Biden's calls. All right, those were some of the online posts there. Let me introduce our first guest for this segment of the Q&A, Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh joins us. He's a political analyst from Tehran. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome to Economic Divide. The Russia-Iran front has been fast evolving, but it really took a step up in its speed. In January of this year, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi went to Moscow, and they both signed on to a strategic cooperation deal of 20 years in duration, building on their good cooperation. And this obviously includes the expansion of economic ties. When it comes to the way that this now works out in the Ukraine war, will things fast track now that Russia is, like Iran, heavily sanctioned?
Iran has a lot of experience in let's say, circumventing or nullifying the sanctions for the last four decades. And now that the Russians are facing sanctions and a lot of economic problems, after the incidents and developments in Ukraine. So there are a lot of things that Tehran can share with Moscow. The point is that the global area, the global era, is moving toward more cooperation in regional levels. So the old world order is actually disappearing right now, and the new world order is actually forcing countries to establish regional cooperation with each other.
All right. Denis Rogatsiak joins us now. Let's see what he thinks. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano, who joins us from Mexico. Denis, welcome to Economic Divide. The first Eurasia Economic Forum actually was just held, and it's regarded as a milestone because it is said that it actually set up the parameters of the geo-economic integration, as it has been called, of the Eurasia heartland. Now, you have Sergei Glazyev, Russia's minister in charge of integration and macroeconomics at that union, that said that there's a drive to design an alternative monetary financial system. Tell us how that works out and how that would undermine the U.S. dollar and, in turn, the U.S. itself, military and politically.
I believe what we're witnessing right now is kind of the phasing out of the U.S. dollar as the financial hegemon across the world. And I believe this is a process that has been taking place for a good part of the last 20 years. Not just with the rise of China, you know, the return of Russia, the drive for greater sovereignty, economic sovereignty across Latin America, say the expansion of the cooperation between the African continent and China, but also, of course, the recent events in Ukraine are actually also pushing towards the rise of Russia and China and Iran as kind of the financial and economic alternative to the United States, as we've seen now with Russia, with its vast economic power, particularly in the energy sector, has effectively been able to set the rules for energy prices with regards to the use of their national currency for purchases. So basically, forcing their partners in Europe and across the world to adopt ruble as the main means of exchange.
It is time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, the Bilderberg Group. That's right, you haven't heard that name in a while. Well, it has reconvened in person after a two-year pandemic gap. It's a high-level council of war, the way it was described. It was headlined by Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. Also within this, I guess, secret or not so secret meeting, a new financial system was also revealed. Of course, that is something that the Bilderberg Group is very much known for, the secrecy and how it executes it for a world order that they deem to be a world order. Next up, U.S. inflation hit a 40-year high of 8.6%. as food, gas, and shelter costs have risen in that country, and that is increasing. And the inflation rate, well, it has sent the stock markets into a tailspin. For example, the S&P 500 has fallen over 2%, and NASDAQ was down over 3.5% as of the recording of this program. Next up, the Americas Summit. The Summit of the Americas was meant to counter China's influence. Instead, it showed how weak the U.S. was. The event was soured by snubs, diplomatic tensions on the rise in that summit, because even before it started, Mexico boycotted it, and others sent low-level delegates. And this is called one of the biggest flops of the Biden presidency and of this particular summit, the Summit of the Americas, hosted by the U.S. Our final pick, stagflation. The World Bank says most countries are headed for a recession, warning of a possible return to what's called the 1970s stagflation, which happened back then. Several years of above-average inflation and below-average growth are now likely because of it. So that is another challenge for not only the world economy, but countries in particular like the U.S. Well, those were the stories that we picked for this section called the InfoNews section. We would love to hear from you.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to sanctions, Iran was one of the countries sanctioned most by the U.S. That's a well-known fact. Although Russia at this point has taken the lead, both can now actually move forward and take the lead together in the way to basically evade sanctions, which is in line with what is unfolding, and that's the new financial order. Now, Sergei Glazyev, you may not have heard of him. He's a leading Russian economist. And he has said that a complete overhaul of the Western-dominated global monetary and financial system is under works, and the world's rising powers are buying into it. Now, this is, of course, countries, when he refers to that, Russia and then Iran, especially when it comes to the whole notion of sanction evasion. Now, the new monetary system, we've talked about that in previous programs. It is still unfolding, and its consequences are pretty dramatic. The Eurasia Economic Union and the China Association together, cooperation between the two, will catapult changes to continue this new financial order. This will ultimately entail the collapse of the dollar system and the final undermining, as a result of that, of the U.S. military and political power. But what was the start of all of this? That's probably a question that you may ask. Well, this was thrown into high gear when U.S., EU, and the U.K. froze the Russian dollars. Reserves, that is, in Western central banks, $630 billion is what we had in terms of the foreign exchange reserves that Russia had. And that was a big mistake. This undermined the status of the dollar as a result, not to mention the euro and the pound as global reserve currencies. This was the death wish for the dollar, as some have said, and the euro, as it undermined, as I just mentioned, the status of the dollar, the euro, and the pound. So that move by the U.S. and its allies, in Europe in particular, undermined the status of the dollar through the confiscation of Russia's currencies in central banks, okay? Now, the use of national currencies and clearing mechanisms backed by bilateral currency swaps is the first phase of this new financial system, okay? There's three phases. The next phase, the new pricing mechanisms that do not reference the dollar. This is the second phase of the new financial system that is occurring as we speak. And then finally, third phase, that is comprised of the creation of a new digital payment currency, weight of each currency, and to make that shorter, is proportional to the GDP of each country. That is important. So there you have the new financial system in just a short form in terms of the explanation. However, let me bring back our guest to break this down further for us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh is a political analyst from Tehran who rejoins us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome back. We're looking at the countries that have been sanctioned, like Iran and Russia, and some have analyzed their cooperation as to be one that is setting new rules in this new financial global order. At this point, that is kind of paving the way for China when it comes to the U.S. sanctions in terms of how it is going to wean off the U.S. dollar as one of the things that it's going to do. We're also looking at Latin American countries who are moving away from the U.S. dollar. Can you please tell us how all of this undermines the U.S. financial system in particular and the Western global stranglehold?
You know, there is a great opportunity right now for the sanctioned countries to work with each other. We would call it the sanction club, we can say. The club of countries that are sanctioned, put under the sanction of the Americans. And this is actually the fault of the Americans, that they overused actually their system of weaponization of dollar by imposing sanctions on countries across the world, and Iran, and Venezuela, and Cuba, and Russia, and Syria, and Lebanon, and many countries. They are imposing actually sanctions on. And this has created a club of countries that can work with each other without fear of further sanctions. Because Iran has been sanctioned to the most, and even a Trump administration admitted that they don't have any further sanctions to impose on Iran, and there is no further fear of any more sanctions.
All right, let's bring in Denis Rogatyuk. He rejoins us. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano. Denis Rogatyuk, welcome back. When you take a look at countries like Russia and Iran, they're the ones that have been leading the pack, so to speak, of Western sanctions, in particular by the U.S. This is in line with the new financial order that we're looking at, and people have referred to it as the New World Order. Can you tell us how this is going to reshape the way that countries are going to deal with each other away from the U.S. dollar?
Most definitely. We have to remember that Cuba, one of the countries sanctioned by the United States and blockaded by the United States, is actually an observer state to the Eurasian Economic Forum and already has extensive trade deals and investment deals with both Russia and China, sort of their two traditional trading partners. So I believe that Cuba will certainly play a huge part in helping to construct this new financial world order in across Latin America. But we also can't forget, you know, the role of Venezuela. Venezuela has traditionally been a key pillar in the world production of gas and oil, even despite the mass U.S. sanctions that have been imposed on the country. It continues to have an important role in OPEC.
Russia-Iran economic cooperation is not limited to bilateral ties. Russia is a founding member of the Eurasian Economic Union, which includes post-Soviet states located in Eurasia. A free trade agreement between Iran and the Eurasian Economic Union came into force in October 2019. That means that Iran and other member states and trading partners, which include China, will have the opportunity to enjoy free business and trade without the interference of the U.S. and its Western allies.
روسیه و سایر کشورهای عضو اتحادیه طبیعتاً اهمیت این اتحادیه و توسعه روابط ما با اون خودش رو بیشتر بروز و ظهور
میده. The sticking point though is the integration of the financial systems of respective countries. Russia has created its own payment system for electronic fund transfers called MIR.
Ми підготувалися по фінансовій системі, ми створили свою систему аналог SWIFT. Система передачи финансовых сообщений. У нас создана своя система платежных карт, виза. Вместо визы и мастер-карт у нас работает карта МИР. Поэтому в этой части мы подготовили финансовую инфраструктуру, и она сейчас работает.
China's UnionPay system, which is becoming popular in Asian states, has become the largest card payment processing organization. But Chinese banks and its banking systems have been cautious in their ties with Russia over fears of sanctions. But Russia and Iran are turbocharging mutual settlements in their national currencies to the highest possible level. Iran is also set to accept Russia's MIR card payments, which means that the countries will be connecting their banks to the system for transfer of financial messages, or SPFS. The Russian equivalent to SWIFT. Moscow is eyeing crypto and digital currencies already, and Beijing is dead set on setting up the digital yuan to work around SWIFT, something that it has enacted already and has been used in many countries or provinces in China.
In this program, we have covered how Russia and Iran have paved the way for other countries, in particular on how to evade illegal sanctions that are applied by the U.S. to counter U.S.'s imperialistic and hegemonic aspirations. This is in line with the shift in the new financial world order. Now Iran has a new proposal, which would speed things up to that end. Iran has approached the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, with a proposal to create a new single currency. This would be used for carrying out trade among the members of the Eurasian bloc that includes China, India, and Russia, three of the largest emerging economies of the world. This would be another way to counter the increasing weaponization of the U.S. dollar, from sanctions to the dollar-denominated financial system. Tehran's proposal came during the time when the U.S. and its Western allies were announcing economic sanctions against Russia over its military conflict with Ukraine. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, earlier this month told the media that the proposal was sent to the SCO nearly 2 months ago. Iran hopes that the Eurasian bloc that it views as a concert of non-Western great powers will respond to the constantly changing geopolitical landscape and accept its proposal in due course. For Iran and Russia, this new currency will have immediate benefits. The two countries will be able to circumvent illegal Western sanctions to trade more openly with their SCO partner countries. Let's not forget, the SCO accounts for 44% of the world population and about a quarter of the global GDP. But do the benefits or gains outweigh the risks for other SCO members that are not the target of U.S. sanctions? Why should they gamble on this new currency for anyways? According to an estimate, the SCO countries lose approximately 10 to 20 billion U.S. dollars annually only on transaction and conversion charges. Still confused about why Iran has proposed the adoption of a new currency? Well, this should clear up any ambiguities for you. While many of the SCO countries have already initiated trading in local currencies with each other and in the process minimizing the use of the U.S. dollar as the currency of exchange, these transactions are mostly bilateral in nature. There's a need for either a common currency or a common payment platform that could automatically be used by each of the SCO members while trading with each other. That does it for this section of the program.
There's a new world order, and by default, a new financial order is also taking shape. We've said that time and again. But that is driven by countries who are working against the U.S. and Western hold on the world financial system, who have exercised various methods to control these countries, either through sanctions or otherwise. And perhaps this momentum is too fast for the U.S. to catch up to, which is good in one way, but bad in another way, because a political and military power like the U.S. is not going to give up its super status that easily. And we may see some negative reactions coming from that. That does for this edition of the program. From Mikhail Vitahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati habni libtida'i karamak wa salifi birrika bi ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi أتراك معذبي بنارك بعد توحيدك وبعد من طوى علي قلبي من معرفتك ولهج به لساني من ذكرك واعتقده ضميري من حبك
صدق اعترافي ودعائي خاضعا لربوبيتك.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this part of the Kumaya supplication. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the believers, in this excerpt states, Ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi, my Allah, my master, my Lord, aturaka mu'adhibi binarika ba'da tawhidik, can you be seen tormenting me with your fire after I have professed to your oneness? Wa ba'da man tawa alayhi qalbi min ma'rifatik, after your cognition my heart has embraced. وَلَهِجَ بِهِ لِسَانِي مِنْ ذِكْرِكَ, after the remembrance of you my tongue has constantly mentioned. وَعَتَقَدَهُ ضَمِيرِي مِنْ حُبِّكَ, and my mind has clung to the love of you. وَبَعْدَ صِدْقِ اعْتِرَافِي وَدُعَائِي خَاضِعًا لِرُبُوبِيَتِكَ, and after the sincerity of my confession and my supplication before your lordship. In the previous episode, we started discussing the concept of monotheism. أَتُرَاكَ مُعَذِّبِي بِنَارِكَ بَعْدَ تَوْحِيدِكَ, I have believed, I have professed to your oneness, unity, and I have believed in monotheism. The supplicant is saying that he is muwahid, he is a true monotheist. We also try to discuss the different aspects of a practical belief in Allah's oneness. Let us continue our discussion from this part. The practical aspects of belief in Allah's oneness that we also discussed in the previous episode is requested from the people by the divine books, by the prophets, by the infallible imams. I assume this is because the most obvious sign of disbelief is like verbal polytheism, is practical polytheism afterwards. That is why monotheism has been the most important aspect of the Prophet's invitation. Practical monotheism is very effective in human life, in a virtualization of this human nature, the nature of which is materialistic. That is why the prophets have all tried to rescue this man from slavery and imperial powers. They have all explicitly stated that they are determined to purify human societies from polytheism and grant freedom and greatness to those people. And the reason why the pharaohs and the tyrant rulers opposed monotheism is because its practical aspect was dangerous for their tyranny. And another reason for the Prophet's invitation to monotheism was that polytheism of some cheap people had resulted in their despotism, as the Holy Quran states, إِنَّهُمْ كَانُوا إِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ يَسْتَكْبِرُونَ. Surely, they used to behave proudly when it was said to them, there is no God but Allah. We'll be back after a short break.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity, and despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity. No, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah,
God, let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
We said about this part of the Kumaya supplication that the most important part of invitation of all the prophets has been a monotheism. And one of the main reasons why they invited people to monotheism was that they wanted to cure the proud people. إِنَّهُمْ كَانُوا إِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ يَسْتَكْبِرُونَ. This phrase was considered a threat for the oppressors. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. They wanted to oppose. They wanted to oppress other people. They wanted to dominate their nation. And they wanted the others to be deprived from their rights. And confessing to Allah's oneness abolished obligatory obedience to them. This negated their orders and concessions. And that is why belief in Allah's oneness, uniqueness, and the sameness of His essence with His attributes is the perfect monotheism. Monotheism, in its true nature, is belief in the oneness and unity of the Lord, who is the ruler of everything. He is the absolute cause, in whose hands lies life, death, creation, hidden and apparent aspects of literally everything. In other words, it is belief in the Lord to whom people are invited by the prophets, by the imams, and whose rules should be obeyed. It is denying any tyrant and oppressor ruler. So one who confesses that there is no deity save Allah, and none holds any influence in this universe save Allah, and there is neither a might nor power except with Allah, is a real believer. Thank you for staying with us, brothers and sisters. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.